QED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Michael Krasny, Tristan Harris is a former design ethicist for Google, and he knows why we can't put our smartphones down.
There's a hidden goal driving the direction of all of the technology we make, and that goal is the race for our attention.
Harris says that today's smartphones and the apps they use are deliberately engineered to interrupt our thoughts, hijack our attention, keep us scrolling, tapping, and swiping for as long as possible. He joins us to talk about how we can gain control back from our devices. That's coming up next, right after this news. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. Well, if you're like a lot of people, you're constantly refreshing your news feeds, checking your Facebook likes, dropping everything at the ping of a text message. Well, if that describes you, well, it's probably not your fault, at least not entirely. Tristan Harris is a former design ethicist for Google, and he says tech companies deliberately engineer smartphones and apps to make them as distracting, addictive, and time-sucking as possible. Today, Tristan Harris is the head of a nonprofit movement. It's called Time Well Spent, and he joins me this hour to talk about how we consumers can liberate ourselves from our phones. Tristan Harris, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us why this topic is important.
Well, it's profound because 2 billion people every day in the morning get up, and one of the first things many people do with a smartphone in their pocket is you reach over and you grab your phone. And from that moment, there's an entire set of thoughts that start going through people's minds about who they owe a response to. Oh, the world's moving so fast. Oh, I've got to get back to these people.
Look what Trump's done.
I mean, it's this whole construct that just floods your mind the second you wake up. And it's literally like being jacked into the Matrix. So there's this small set of companies, you know, 3, 4, 5 companies that really design this environment that suddenly 2 billion people's minds are immersed inside of from the moment they get up to the moment they fall asleep. Every toilet break, every line, every coffee line, every, you know, whatever. We check these things 150 times a day. And so the real question is, how do you ethically steer what 2 billion people will be thinking today? And that obviously has implications across every domain of life and culture.
Why do you say ethics? And you were an ethicist at Google.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a new position they created for you? Why did they feel they needed an ethicist?
Well, actually, there's a longer story behind that. I made a presentation that was basically about, as a regular product manager, about the need for ethics. And the presentation ended up going viral within Google. That's how I got to do what I did for a little while, which was basically to ask, how do you ethically persuade or manipulate or touch people's psychological triggers? Because every single day, email operates like a slot machine. You know, your Facebook newsfeed operates like a slot machine. You pull to refresh, and you're waiting those couple of seconds, and it's just like a slot machine because that variable delay creates that reward loop. And there's never been a question about how do you ethically tap into all of these psychological instincts. And whether we wanted to or not, these tech companies are bumping their elbow, and a billion people's minds are responding. And so, how do you have a framework for deciding how do you ethically steer people's thoughts?
What are some of the elements of that framework, do you think?
There's so many different aspects to this. The first thing is that what most people don't know is that technology companies aren't just offering these services as like neutral products. There's this narrative that these are just neutral tools, and then it's just up to choose them. We can use them however we want. That's not true. And it's not true because they're specifically designed in most cases to capture attention. And it's not because there's some evil, manipulative, malicious person who's sitting there, you know, stroking their mustache saying, I can't wait to, you know, capture all of people's attention. It's just that's the business model. I mean, let's just be really simple about it.
That's how they make money.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't make anybody evil. Let's just be really honest about the incentives. If your goal is to get eyeballs on a screen, you make more money the more attention and time people spend on your service. And not just the time and attention, but the hook, the thing that causes you to want to come back tomorrow. And so it becomes this arms race because there's only so much attention. So you have to figure out how can I get people's attention? And that becomes this arms race for what are the buttons I can push inside of someone's mind to get them to come back.
What are some of the buttons that they're currently pushed?
Well, so one that we've talked about in this TED Talk that came out recently that talked about this is Snapchat, which is the number one, communication tool used by teenagers. So for you and I, our age, we use texting to communicate. You have to remember that for Snapchat, that's the number one way. That's like their primary texting tool, right?
And just say what the difference is between Snapchat and texting.
Oh, well, I mean, you know, people post these or send these sort of auto-exploding photos
GIFs
that disappear. GIFs or photos of themselves, they disappear. You can also chat and send, you know, text messages, but they automatically disappear. That's what Snapchat's different.
Although... sometimes not.
Sometimes not. There's different nuances. But one of the things that they did is they invented a feature called streaks. So streaks, basically, if you imagine just like in your text messaging, you have a number of different people that you've recently texted with. Next to each person, they put the number of days in a row that you've sent a message back and forth. So it's like how many times have you tossed the football? But the number goes away if you don't send a message today to keep up your streak. So what they just did, if you think about it, is they've tied two kids' legs together on a string and put both on a treadmill and hit start. Because now both kids have to keep passing these messages back and forth. Otherwise, they lose their streak.
Why is it so hard just to say, I don't care?
Well, exactly. And so you'd say, if we go back to the ethics of it, you know, here I was at Google asking myself this question of how should the whole technology industry think about what's wrong with this? So let's just be honest. So if I'm a product manager at Snapchat, I would say, well, what's the big deal? It's just a number. I mean, the kids can ignore it.
But I mean, even the kids, why is it so hard for the kids to say, I don't care. I mean, you know, I'll text them tomorrow or Snapchat them tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, and so theoretically, it should be really easy. But the thing that people don't realize is this taps into really deep psychology and it taps into loss aversion. People don't want to lose something. So once you have this, you know, the more days in a row you have, the harder it is, the more expensive it is to lose that thing. And it turns out this is not theoretical. There's a woman named Emily Weinstein at Harvard who actually discovered the way that this causes stress in kids' lives accidentally while she was doing other research. Her paper on this just came out. I'm sure people can find it online. And it basically showed that kids have... you know, so many of these things going, they give their password to like five other friends when they're on vacation to keep their streaks going in their absence.
Wow.
And it's a cause of real stress in their lives. And they feel like their friendship, the terms of their friendship are defined by whether or not they're able to keep that streak up or not. Hmm. So again, ask about the ethics of this, right? So what makes this bad? Just because Snapchat's doing this, what makes this so bad? Well, it's because their goals when designing this feature are not the same as our children's goals. Most children don't even realize that this is actually what's going on. Right?
How is it different, though, from, you know, television, for mm-hmm. example?
Well, so this is common as well. You know, why are we always worry about new technologies and we always worry about smartphones and, you know, this is the same as when we were just gossiping on the telephone. They're just gossiping with each other on you know, Snapchat. What makes this different? Well, the difference is that, first of all, we never had something so intimately linked into the sort of the fundamental structure or fabric of our lives. So from the moment you get up in the morning, like literally the moment you get up, you turn off your alarm and you pull over your phone, you didn't wake up in the morning and the first moment turn on your TV and then keep your TV with you in your hand as you walked around the house in the morning, right? So that the frequency and the footprint that this thing has in our lives from the moment we wake up to the moment we're going to bed, the intimacy in our lives, that's the first thing that makes it so different. The second is that the ability to manipulate the social psychology. So it's one thing for an advertisement to be able to persuade you individually or a marketer to be able to send a message at you through television or something. It's another thing for a company like Snapchat or Facebook or LinkedIn, which has this control over your social relationships, to kind of tap one person on the shoulder and then tap the other person on the shoulder and make them look at each other at the right time so you can orchestrate social interactions between people. Social persuasion is much more powerful and effective than individual persuasion.
Talking with Tristan Harris, he is a design thinker and co-founder of Time Well Spent. That's a movement to align technology with our humanity. Do companies? You said there are about four, five companies. I'm assuming Google, Facebook. Who else is in on this?
So there's sort of different layers. There's the people who kind of design the environment. That's really Google and Apple because they make the phones, and that's the landscape on top of which everyone else competes for this finite resource of attention. But if you look at just total time spent, you know, it's really Google, Apple, Facebook, Snapchat. YouTube or where people spend their time. I mean, keep in mind, there's 2 billion active users of Facebook. That's more than the number of followers of Christianity. There's 1.5 billion active users of YouTube. That's more than the followers of Islam. So these services have arguably more influence over people's daily thoughts than in some cases certain religions. And so we have to ask, again, what is the ethics of that influence?
Are they influencing the thought, or are they just influencing the way you're spending your time?
Both. I mean, because by influencing the environment that your mind is inside of, they can influence how you spend your time. So a good example of this that makes that really clear is YouTube. So if you're competing for attention, what do you do in your YouTube? You say, okay, how would I get people to spend more time on YouTube? And you say, well, people like watching videos. Why don't I, instead of waiting for people to click on one of the related videos, why don't I autoplay the next video, right? So we make that circle go.
There's no chance for them to leave.
And let's say that works pretty well. Let's say that increases time spent by like 5%. So now if you're any of the other attention companies, you just lost some market share because there's only so much attention. So now you're Netflix and you're sitting there and you're a product manager at Netflix sitting in wherever their offices are. And you say, okay, let's compete back. Let's actually autoplay the next episode in all of our videos, right? And then if you're Facebook sitting there saying, gosh, you know, all these companies are autoplaying videos, we're losing out. We have to autoplay all of the videos in the Facebook news feed.
Interesting.
Do you remember that? That change only happened in the last year and a half.
Yeah, and of course there's not a big announcement about what they're doing, right?
No, of course. And there's no new terms of service or no new consent. They just do these things. And what no one realizes is that it's not going to go another way. We're not going to suddenly get more self-control. It's not going to suddenly become less persuasive. We're going in a one-way direction towards the internet feeling more and more persuasive at offering what will perfectly tap into your psychology. And this is why it's so important, because this is getting, you know, harder and harder to sort of control our own minds and also our kids' minds. And it has, you know, implications across every domain of life.
You said this position of ethicist was sort of created at Google after a talk you gave went viral. And of course, you're not at Google anymore. How did what you were saying and doing while you were at Google, how did it go over among, you know, the higher ups at the company?
Yeah, well, the way that this originally happened, it was never actually a formal talk. What I made was a presentation, like a slide deck, and I sent it. It was called a call to minimize distraction and respect human attention. And I sent it to 10 people for feedback. It basically said, never before in history have 50 mostly men, mostly white, mostly young people sitting in 50 miles of San Francisco shaped what a billion people are thinking. And it made the argument that people's minds are vulnerable and easily manipulated, and that technology manipulates it every day, accidentally, whether we want to or not, and we have a responsibility. Mm-hmm. I sent this presentation to about, 15 people, close friends of mine, and said, hey, I'd love your feedback on this. When I went to work the next day, there was 150 simultaneous viewers in the top right-hand corner on the Google presentation. And later that day, there was 400, simultaneous viewers of the presentation. And so it had started catching on within the whole company. And, you know, at some point, something like 6,000, 10,000 people had seen it. The overall response was incredibly positive. I think the challenge is, how do we do something about it? Because on a human level, everyone understands that, you know, there's a problem, I think. And I think it's never been more clear in terms of just where things are in society right now. The challenge is that the product roadmaps all were sort of set. I mean, there's no ability to change course radically when the business model is attention for advertising, right?
When you say that, clearly we have a problem. I mean, do those companies feel there's a problem? I mean, do they see an ethical aspect to this? And of course, companies are people, but you know, so I mean,
yeah,
according to the Supreme Court,
right.
But you know, do the CEO and the folks that run these companies, are they concerned about the ethical implications?
Well, I think that's kind of why I think on a human level everybody is, and I think there's an inability to see that situation clearly. It's very easy to justify, you know, if you're the CEO of Snapchat. Well, look at all the. I'm sure people met their spouses or their you know, boyfriends or girlfriends through these snap streaks or something like that. There's all these good outcomes that could happen through all this technology. But it's easy to kind of deceive ourselves about whether or not, because we're offering so many benefits, it's easy to say, you know, everything is going really well. Maybe it isn't such a big problem or there's all these good side effects. But I think we have to look at the structure of the problem. And the structure is the goals of technology are to capture more and more attention persuasively. That's not the goals of society. That's different. And it's fundamentally misaligned. And so that's why I had to leave, because we need to be able to talk about this independently and fight for what's just best for people instead of what's best for more screen time.
You said something interesting a moment ago. You said never in the history of humanity have so few mostly white, mostly men, people within 50, you know, miles, square miles of San Francisco influenced 2 billion people. Is there an aspect... The fact that it is so many of these folks are men and so many are white,
yep.
Which of course is a big issue in a lot of ways in Silicon Valley, the lack of diversity. What are some of the influences that the lack of diversity, how does that affect what we're talking about here? The fact that it is mostly white men making these decisions and designing these platforms and products.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's like anything. I mean, I think anything that's designed inside of a bubble of experience where from the moment you get to work on a bus and you land at a cafeteria and you have, you know, food that's laid out for you and you have, if you just think about like what is the actual phenomenological experience of someone who goes to work, you know, from the moment you get in the car here in San Francisco, again, the bus, usually you arrive at work, there's like a Google Calendar of just meetings, you're writing code, you go to the cafeteria for lunch and talk about things with other people who are in this privileged environment. It's not that that's evil or bad or totally disconnected in the castle, but there is a kind of self-enclosed bubble automatically there. And that fundamentally means that you're not in touch with, you know, how does this affect kids? I mean, here's a good example. The fact that the average age of people, I think Facebook's average age is much younger. I think it's like 25 to 35, I would guess, more in that range. A company like Apple would be older. Google would be a little bit between probably Facebook and Apple. But the age really matters, because if you don't have anyone in the company with kids, for example, how sensitive would you be to what this is doing to that generation, right? And I think that that is a huge blind spot, especially at a young company like Snapchat where, as I understand it, the founders are like 24 or 25 years old.
You mentioned earlier that a lot of young people feel a lot of pressure to sort of keep up on social media. What are some of the other implications, not just in terms of the pressures, but, you know, the way these products and applications and the smartphones generally affect the way kids' brains are developing and their relationships are affected?
Yeah, well, the thing that worries me the most is when it changes the meaning of friendship. So, you know, what is being a friend about? Well, you know, the thing about that Snapstreaks example is that, you know, when talking to Emily Weinstein, that Harvard researcher who I saw semi-recently, you know, when kids start to say, the way I know that I am friends with this person is because we are the top streak with each other. You know, when that's how someone defines friendship, they're defining it on the terms that a private company in Venice, California, invented this manipulative feature. And so, you know, when you think about persuasion, this is how I often like to think about it. When the persuader's goals actually don't just persuade you, when their goals become your goals, when you start to value the things that they wanted you to value, that's a successful advertisement, right? If I'm Coca-Cola, I want you not to just buy the product. I want you to value what I wanted you to value. In the case of like my identity or my social relationships, like if I'm a kid using Snapchat, to define my friendship on the terms that some private company wanted me to value my friendship by, that's when it starts to get really perverse. It's almost like they're hollowing, you know, they drilled a hole in the back and they just injected this new code. And now I'm running around valuing something that is not the same as what I should be defining my friendship on or my self-worth on. You know, another example is, if people start to devalue their own self-worth based on how many followers that they have, which a lot of kids do. And it's not the same as where our self-worth intrinsically might come from. And I think these are huge implications that a whole generation will not have known differently.
You mentioned in one of your TED Talks about the choices that aren't there, you know, when we're deciding what to do with whatever we're doing on Facebook or Snapchat. Describe some of the choices that aren't there but maybe you think should be to make people more aware of what's happening.
Yeah. Well, so really the way to think about this is that every screen is kind of offering a menu of choices. And so people always say, well, what's the problem with, you know, even if you talk to people at Facebook, they're like, hey, look, we're trying to provide the best set of like content that's out there. Like what else should be on the menu? And maybe the answer is not content. So, for example, if you want to talk about something controversial, talk about political discourse in this country right now, and you post something about like the alt-right or something like this, and By first of all, people have a hard time posting about these topics in the first place. But when you do, the only options that are given on the screen are a like button and a comment box. And the comment box is basically saying, which key do you want to type in response to this? Which key? So the menu is, of all possible choices to talk about a controversial topic, we're offering you a totally complete menu of which key do you want to type. But that's a very limited way to think about having conversations with each other, especially about something controversial. And if you could choose to bump your elbow and send a billion people to have conversations about controversial topics by typing stuff on keyboards into two-paragraph text boxes, or you could choose between a default choice of allowing people to schedule time to talk to each other over, say, dinner Tuesday night, would you want people to talk about controversial topics inside of two-paragraph text boxes where they're bound to misinterpret each other and misunderstand each other?
And they're talking past each other.
And they're talking past each other and proving that they know something. So we have to ask, like, what is the choice architecture or the menu that's being provided by these screens? And you can imagine a different way to do this. So you asked, what's the other way? Well, imagine there's just like there's a post-a-status update, post-a-photo, post-a-video, there could be something like, I want to talk about something controversial. And that's like a specific gesture. And in doing so, maybe underneath it's like, you know, what's missing from this perspective, or what would change my mind, or what, you know, what are some little known facts that disagree with this perspective? So you could structure that differently on the screen, or you could have a second tab that's like, hey, do you want to get people together to talk about this controversial thing? And instead of saying, for example, which friends do you want to invite? It could say, what would be a different mix of people to bring together to talk about this conversation? The questions that we pose to people on the screen control the kinds of actions that we take. And again, never before in history have these tech companies had so much influence on how we think about these questions in our lives and what we end up doing with all of our time.
Another point you make, we're coming up to a break, but is that you know, the way in which all these apps interrupt us, and there's no real thought about do you want to be interrupted? Do you know you're interrupting this other person when you send them a text? Maybe they should have the option of sort of holding back texts until they're ready. I mean, that's another sort of choice that's not there right now.
Yeah. I think of this like, you know, what we really need is some good urban planning so that there's basically more structure to that prevents and protects all our attention.
All right. Tristan Harris is with us for the rest of this hour. He is a design thinker and started a movement called Time Well Spent, trying to align technology with our humanity. We'd love to hear from you about your time spent on your cell phone and with Facebook and Snapchat, whatever it might be. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. You can also email your comments and questions. It's forum at kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. And welcome back to Forum. We're talking with design ethicist Tristan Harris on, among other things, how to fight back against your smartphone, which, Tristan, you've described as a slot machine in your pocket.
Yeah, that's how it is.
Intermittent rewards.
Yep.
I want to give out the phone number once again. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. And, of course, you can also send your comments to forum at kqed.org, or you can tweet at us. We're at KQED Forum. Read a few of those comments. JD tweets, does social media fear of missing out link to addictive characteristics? Fear of missing out, Tristan?
Yeah, absolutely. The fear of missing out or the fear of missing something important on both counts is something that's built into our minds, right? I mean, it would be evolutionarily beneficial to automatically have your attention sent to what might I be missing out on, especially in a social environment. And especially with kids, this is very obvious, but Instagram and Snapchat never make it more obvious when your other friends are hanging out without you. So it's never been easier to know when your friends are hanging out without you. And knowing that has an impact, right? Imagine you just had a human being in a cage and you could just show them whenever you wanted, you know, images of other people hanging out without them. That just would affect them, right? You can't control whether it affects you. It does affect you. And then you could choose how you would respond to that. So if you think of them as like I hate to say this, but like if you imagine a sort of a lab rat style metaphor, how often would you want to subject a human being to that experience? Probably not that often, but our phones basically make that available all the time. And it starts to consume all of our time and our stress and our thoughts.
And it comes back to what you said about it. Then you want to get activated to make sure you're back in the loop of those friends by liking something, by sending them a message.
Which benefits the companies because it means that you're spending more attention on the service. Yeah.
Here's another comment from Katie who tweets, how can user experience and product designers persuasively speak up about making ethical design decisions to business stakeholders? How can we make them see the importance of ethics when their focus is increasing return on investment? Fundamental question.
Yeah. I mean, I think the reason that we need to sort of go up a level is you can't ask anyone, like let's say YouTube, right? Their whole business model is getting more attention. So it's very hard to fight for ethics when ethics means don't get as much attention. You can't ask someone whose business model is more attention to not go for attention. So I think the place where ethics has a role is at the level of Google and Apple, who make the devices and the screens that we live by, that all these apps sit on top of. So I think Apple is the one company, by the way, whose incentives, because they mostly sell hardware, would enable them to change the device to protect human attention and to protect the things that we care about and give us more freedom and agency.
Give us an example of what they might do.
There's so many things. I mean, so one thing, for example, is showing people a reflection of their habits, right? And saying, hey, this is how I see you waking up in the morning. This is what you tend to do. It's like the first 30 minutes, you spend 10 minutes on Twitter, then you spend 20 minutes on email and 5 minutes on Facebook. And then it would ask you, like, is that what you want your morning to look like? And then it would let you adjust the dials in such a way that your screen in the morning doesn't bombard you with that stuff. It makes it easier to live by your values as opposed to, you know, becoming a channel for all these apps to demand your attention.
Is there an example of where that has been put into practice?
I mean, not yet, I think is the problem. And that's why these companies really need to do a lot more, and they can do more. And Apple's in a fantastic position to do a lot more.
All right, let's go to the phones now, and we'll begin in Pacifica with Meg. You're on with Tristan Harris. Good morning.
Hi, I want to applaud the effort. I'm actually a tech worker, worked at a couple of those companies, but I recently had a kidney transplant and been out for several months recovering, and one of the first things I did was turn off all notifications from all social media platforms, texting apps and so forth, just because I found I was just navel-gazing and I had a lot of the FOMO going on. But, you know, by turning everything off, it allowed me to sleep a little bit better, and it allowed me to get, like, recenter myself and get back to just some creative spots that I'd been missing mentally, to think more about the world, to start reading, and I actually started coding recently. So I really applaud the efforts going on here to help people just take a step back.
Meg, I'm curious, when you did that, what reaction did you get from your friends or the people that you communicate with on those different platforms?
People will wait. I mean, you know, when you text, I talk with my parents about this all the time. Like, you don't have to answer your device immediately, like, unless it's a clear emergency. People will wait. They'll assume you're doing something else, and you can come back to it in your own time, and no one really notices.
And Tristan, this is a case of basically the consumer taking control.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's wonderful to hear that, and I think that's one of the simplest things that everybody can do is to realize that most notifications on phones are actually invented by machines. They're not even from other people. When it says your friend invited you to connect on LinkedIn or your friend posted on Facebook and they tagged you, We think that's a message from someone and we need to get back to it. But that was actually invented by a product manager at a technology company whose like performance and goals and rewards in the company come from getting you to come back. So one thing we can all do is just turn off almost all notifications except for when an individual person is texting or messaging you specifically.
All right, Meg, thanks so much for the call. Let's go now to Sacramento. John, welcome.
Yeah, hi, thanks. First, I want to thank the guest for the work he's doing. I think it's tremendously important because of the numbers you mentioned earlier. My question was about the Stanford University Psychology Department. I read an article 3 months ago, I think, in Atlantic that just creeped me out. It said they were just cherry-picking these really smart people from that department to basically do persuasion and manipulation. I'm wondering if you could comment on that.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. So this is the Stanford Persuasive Technology Lab. I had a professor named BJ Fogg. It's not in the psychology department. It's sort of somewhere between psychology and computer science. There's a misconception about this lab that I want to make sure I get right here, which is it's not that they taught people how to manipulate people. They didn't teach young students how to manipulate. What they really taught us was how to recognize persuasion. They taught us how to look at the world and look at design and look at these technology products through the lens of how are they persuading people to do these things? And then we did look at the literature of persuasion. So Robert Cialdini's book, Influence, and there's books on dog training. There's all sorts of these other, you know, disciplines around how people get persuaded. What people don't know is that there's an extension and sort of whole sort of ecosystem of workshops and classes and courses and, you know, conferences called Hooked and things like that, where they actually do teach you deliberate techniques on how to kind of hook people in. And you have people speaking at conferences like that saying things like, oh, when users don't want to use it anymore, that's okay. You just, you know, do this other technique and it gets them to come back. And you hear this stuff and you're like, what is the ethics of all of this? And that's where that motivation really comes from.
John, thanks very much for the call. Tristan, I remember reading as I was getting ready for the show that you were, as a kid, a magician.
Yep.
And I'm wondering, what did you learn from that about, you know, distracting people and illusion and drawing people in?
Well, fundamentally, studying magic, you know, is really just the first lens in studying psychology. I mean, I think the magicians often know more about the actual practical elements of, you know, immediate day-to-day human psychology than a lot of the psychology departments at many universities. It really teaches you that there's sort of blind spots. Where are those blind spots? What is the purpose of attention? If I draw your attention over here, you know, I studied pickpocketing a little bit, and it's just fascinating that people can't see what they can't see. That when you present a set of choices on a menu, no one asks you why they're being given those choices and what's not on the menu. And I think you can look at technology as doing that. It's providing menus of choices that hides all sorts of other things. And you would never know why aren't I being given other choices.
And picking your pocket maybe at the same time.
And maybe picking your pocket in terms of attention, yeah.
Okay. Let's go now to San Jose. Herb, welcome.
Hi. I have a comment about something you said previously, or a question, I guess. Doesn't it seem like these social media people are tapping into something even more primal? As an example, if you're a zebra, you're in a herd, and for you to survive and just be alive, you've really got to see what's going on with the rest of the herd. If you don't, then you're likely to be the one that might be eaten by the lions. And so, to a certain extent, not that we have to be afraid of being eaten by lions in social media world per se, but I think these guys are tapping into something extremely primal that's even deeper than what I think you were referring to earlier. And personally, I sort of, even though I've been in high tech for 30, where I was in high tech for 30 plus years, I tend to think of Facebook as more like, it should be better called jealous book, because it ends up making so many people subliminally jealous. Anyway, thank you. Great conversation.
Yeah, thanks very
much. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think people don't really realize that, I mean, they do realize, as you just said, that there's very deep human evolutionary instincts being played on here. It's very useful and very important to know what other people are thinking about you or saying about you, or when other people in your social group are hanging out and you're not invited. This has all sorts of implications for us. So this is tapping into the social stuff especially. That's what's new about this. If we think historically, right? I mean, there's always technology. There's always these tools. There's always email, communication. But the social element, the ability to know at any given moment, you know, my belonging, where I sit in the sort of social hierarchy, That's really new, and it's being it can be deliberately manipulated to get attention. And it's really, I think people, we might look back at this period and say social media might be like the tobacco companies.
I was going to say, it's like, you know, in some ways you're also asking these companies, like tobacco companies, to take the nicotine out of the cigarettes. You know, that's what drives people to their products.
That's right. And it, you know, it's sad because obviously there's also benefits that are conferred by these products. It's not that they're not also trying to benefit us. It's just that they're playing with such delicate parts of the human psyche. This is the most vulnerable and deep and primal parts of the human psyche. And so in doing it, we ought to have a much deeper, richer way of protecting the way this goes, especially since we just know, and it's so obvious the way it is affecting especially teenagers and kids.
Well, and it's not just psychology, of course. There's a whole physiological aspect to this as well in terms of the, you know, addictive nature, the reward systems that happen when you're doing what these apps want you to do.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones, and this time we'll go to San Francisco. And Alex, welcome.
Hi, guys. This is all about attention. And don't you think that Facebook, Google, Apple, they're all going to stop worrying about getting all your attention and worry more about specific attention, like your top 3 hours? Because that's really what drives the ads, is trying to get you to buy stuff. And so maybe your 3 prime hours of listening or watching are really where all the attention goes to. Thank you.
Tristan?
Yeah.
Do they really care, like, whether it's, you know, quality time or how many? I mean, they really look – it's looking for quantity of time, right, more than anything?
Yeah, well, I think – I mean, so there's a question of – so long as companies can make more money, the more attention they get. If you even think of it this way, if there is just those 3 hours, let's scale it back, and companies don't want that much attention. They just want those 3 hours. There's this finite amount of 3 hours. Okay. Well, still, to get those 3 hours, it's going to become more and more competitive, and there's still just a few players looking for it. So there's still going to be this arms race. There's still going to be the autoplay race. There's still going to be the social psychology, jealousy race to the bottom of the brainstem. There's going to be all these same tricks to compete for that small, finite resource. And so what we really need to do is say, how do we empower people and not distribute that finite resource of attention based on who's going lower on the brainstem? Let's say, you know, how do we distribute that in a way that's actually, you know, bringing out the higher qualities of human nature?
Some comments here from listeners. Hunter writes, I'm a little let down by this hysteria worship. Apps and phone features can't possibly run solely on attention retention. Google does not do this. Pandora does not do this. Tinder doesn't do it. The gamification features are old news, and consumers are much more sophisticated than the speaker seems to imagine. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, well, so I disagree. I think that, you know, there's this view of persuasion. This comes from my view as a magician, that, oh, those other people over there can be duped, but not me. I'm the one who's okay. And I'm not saying this to accuse anyone. I want to say what I've studied in talking to the top, you know, Nobel Prize-winning behavioral economists in the world and the persuasion experts in the world. I mean, I've talked to all these people. And what they all tell you is that they themselves are vulnerable to the techniques that they teach about. Being human means you're inside of a meat suit and a mind where it is impossible not to care about your social belonging. It is impossible not to care about social approval. It is impossible not to care about how we sit on the social status hierarchy. So that's just being human, and that's always been there. So this is not an accusation. This is just how human beings work. And that's why I said in the TED Talk, what we really need to do is redefine the way that we design products with a care and a protection for these delicate parts of human nature. And so it's not like persuasion, like I'm going to manipulate you. If I show you that your friend was last online, if I show you that your friend knows that you were last online 4 minutes ago and they asked you a big question, they lobbed some really big, deep, provocative question at you, and then you know that by reading it, they saw that you were last online 4 minutes ago. That has an effect on you.
Yeah.
But the last online 4 minutes ago was a design choice by a designer at a California-based tech company. They created that little loop where now you're feeling caught.
You're manipulated.
You're manipulated. And so it's not that an advertiser got you to do something. It's that your entire experience and the feeling of pull is being orchestrated by these small tech companies.
So what do you do to resist that?
Well, that's a good example. So one thing you can do is turn off, these are called social awareness cues. So if you use things like WhatsApp, you can turn off how, you know, if it shows you how
long ago.
How long ago you were online. Also, it's the read receipts. You can turn off read receipts so that people don't know whether you've read their message or not. That can also be a useful feature, but I think by default, knowing that other people know exactly where and when you are and whether you saw their message generates more stress.
It does, but there's also – it can be helpful, I guess, as well.
It can be, and I can imagine like in first responder environments or something like that, in tight groups, it'd be very useful to have that. But in general, if we're choosing the default settings for 2 billion people, I think we can be careful.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. And MC in Palo Alto, you're on with Tristan Harris.
Hi, Tristan. I so appreciate what you're doing here. I'm a media creator and really not wanting to contribute to the profitable amygdala fear stimulation that is so pervasive right now. So I developed a new platform about the changing relationships between humans and animals all around the globe, trying to keep a positive focus. And, of course, you know, the ethical considerations of design and content played into my creating this. Created some slideshows that sort of slow down the brain as people are taking in, as you say, richer, deeper information. I'm wondering if you can talk to me about the slow read movement and whether or not, you know, as it compares to the slow food movement, something that's happening in the culture, but whether you think it will really have any implications or effect across ages and demos on the web.
Slow read movement. I hadn't heard of that.
Yeah, I haven't heard of slow read, but certainly I think what your question goes to is the effect of how quickly we are inside of these environments and how quickly our mind is operating when we're in these environments has a huge effect on our experience. I don't know about you, but I think that there's something going on with reading where most online reading, we're just like skimming so quickly that we don't even remember 90% of the stuff that, you know, we looked at. And if you think about that as an issue, that there's sort of a clock rate of human experience that is more like ergonomic to understanding and reflection. And there's a clock rate which destroys thinking, understanding, and reflection. And knowing that, you could design, like it sounds like this listener's question, you could design things to slow people down. There's design patterns that could cause people to breathe or put little timers on things, to ask more rich, full-featured questions about the whole human that's looking at the page.
All right, MC, thanks very much for the call. Again, the number, if you want to join us in the last 10 minutes or so, 866-733-6786. Let's read some listener comments. Tracy writes, is there research on what this constant checking and being pinged does to the brain development of a child or teen?
You know, I'm not the biggest expert on that. There's a nonprofit called Common Sense Media that does work on digital citizenship. I recommend generally people who are concerned about their own relationship with their kids check that out. I think it's really clear, though. I think there's a temptation with these kinds of things to say, oh, let's wait 10 years and let's figure out what all the studies say and whether or not it's bad or good for people. I think we need to look at, you know, with teachers who've been observing kids for 20 years in classrooms, it's really clear. Who today feels like they can read a book and sustain their attention better than they could 10 years ago?
Well, just anecdotally, I hear from teacher friends who say that young kids especially, the quality of their relationships with other kids is different. Their socialization skills are different. They have a lack of patience.
Right.
All of us, you know, we expect things like if it takes literally a couple seconds for something to load, we go somewhere else.
Right. Absolutely. I think that patience thing, the inability to be patient with non-immediate rewards is going to be a huge problem. And the idea, even if you want to look at this from an economic lens, which I'm more on the moral side, but, you know, what is it going to mean to have a workforce that's coming up that the next generation that cannot withhold, you know, satisfaction for you know things that are just subtly hard. And I feel it in myself, by the way. I mean, I really think that the more immediate these rewards, the harder it is to sort of plow through the hard stuff.
Here's a comment from a teacher. Mike writes, I'm a teacher and education tech coach. How does Tristan suggest educators in schools, especially as we integrate technology, help students recognize their own distractions and manage it as they grow into adults?
Yeah, you know, and again, I'm not the main expert on that. There's a digital citizenship curriculum that Common Sense Media has for a lot of these things. One thing I have been suggesting is, you know, I was on 60 Minutes with Anderson Cooper about 4 months ago to talk about this topic. And I think that children's attitudes towards these things change when they understand that there's a deliberate design behind them, that these are not just these neutral tools that can be used one way or another. there's a very intentional, deliberate design behind them, and that showing kids and hosting these screenings in classrooms of that interview could be helpful.
All right, let's go back to the phones, and Berkeley is our next stop. Jay, welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to actually bring up kind of the elephant in the room that seems to be getting danced around a lot, which is the tech world is obviously pretty strong libertarian kind of Wild West capitalist to a certain extent when it really comes down to it. And what's really being avoided here is the fact that these are utilities. These are things that are reaching everybody now. They are universal. This is not simply an experimentation petri dish anymore. Everybody's using this stuff. What I'm going to say is not necessarily going to happen in the next several years because the current president of the United States, who would have regulatory power over this with the FCC, is a complete case in point of exactly how manipulative these platforms can be and how they can change all kinds of minds and manipulate minds. But there's going to have to be strong government regulatory pressure on these, just as there are on other forms of media, because it's not about censorship. It's about, you know, trying to curb things like these intense psychological tools that are actually damaging people's minds.
Tristan, this is sort of tangential, but I remember a few years ago there were some issues with that I think the FCC weighed in on about the loudness that commercials were being played because they grabbed your attention. I mean,
right.
Do you see this issue is sort of similar, that something where regulation might be called for?
Absolutely, in the sense of if you're just looking at it, we all want to live in a world that doesn't have these negative effects, these negative manipulation type features of it. So there's no one who should disagree with that. I think we would all want that world. I mean, anyone who has kids, even the tech executives, interesting note on that, many technology executives don't let their own kids use this stuff.
There was an article in the Times about that.
And this is so telling. I mean, this is like, you know, the CEO of Lunchables wouldn't let his own kids touch Lunchables, the billion-dollar food product. You know, very similar. And I think that is so telling. And we have to ask, these companies are, like you, like the listener said, might not rein themselves in. There's one way to do this, which is they self-regulate. The other way is you have to actually impose some kind of external force. That's going to come from probably either the EU in the short term, which is important to look at, because that's, as the person mentioned, the U.S. apparatus is not very active right now. Or, you know, the threat of that will lead them to self-regulate. But it's up to us as consumers to make our voices heard that this is a real issue that we need the companies to respond to.
Jay, thanks very much for the call. You know, that we live in such a hyper-political moment, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are, Tristan, about the potential and perhaps the downside of there being so much potential opportunity for politicians, political organizations to manipulate people using all these aspects of these apps that you're talking about.
Yeah, well, this has never been more true. There's, you know, with obviously the last year in the elections, all the stuff about fake news, also the ability to target ads towards susceptible populations and bots and trolls. And there's these whole systems for computational propaganda. There's, you know, many people who are working on this field. But what people don't realize is that, you know, this system, you know, the Facebook advertising engine is like an AI, and it's been given a goal. It says, get people to click on stuff so that we make money, basically, and show whatever works to get people to click and make more money. And it can't distinguish whether there's, you know, a foreign government in there. It can't distinguish whether or not someone's targeting, you know, let me give you an example. I can actually get you to like my Facebook page. If I can get you to like my Facebook page, then I can see the text in your public posts. So I can see your opinions on certain political topics. It turns out there are groups that I know of that basically know that you can mine the text of what someone has said, take their sentiments, their attitudes towards those political topics
based on keywords,
and reflect those sentiments back to you. And create news that confirms your attitudes and then steers you even more radically down the trail to more extreme views. And this has been done and measurably changed people's opinions in the same way that the Facebook happiness study showed that if we show people a bunch of happy posts, it makes people more happy. You can also steer in any way you want. And the problem is that there's this back door now to 2 billion people's minds in any language, in any election around the world. And all you have to do is pay the most. There's no way for these companies to manually review every single advertiser. And what we're creating is a hyper-personalized persuasion engine that can be used for in really, really bad and dangerous ways.
Let's go try to sneak in one more call here, and we'll go to Davis and Genevieve. Welcome.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for taking me as your last call. I am someone who is, has fallen into the trap of the smartphone and the apps and the instant gratification of being on it throughout the day. And I'm just wondering, I know you've touched on it a little bit here and there, and you've talked about kind of the greater, regulatory things that can happen or what Google and Apple can do. But what can we as individuals, on a daily basis kind of do? I know you mentioned, turning your notifications off, but do you have any other kind of tips as far as like what we as individuals and consumers can do to kind of not let ourselves get caught up in all of this?
Tristan?
Yeah. One thing is I recommend if you go to the Time Well Spent website, we have some tips on our Take Control page that gives people some recommendations about things you can do individually. Things like turning off notifications. You can try turning your screen to black and white if you have a real problem with the color rewards actually generate some kind of intrinsic kind of reward value. Calling over texting, I think scrambling the apps on your home screen, just putting the tools on the home screen, learning to type the names of apps, because when you type something you want to open instead of tap the icon, typing forces you to make a conscious choice. You can't unconsciously move your fingers and type the name of something. There's also habits, like you can say when you sit down with a friend at dinner, you trade phones with each other and set the timers for, an hour and a half. And so you know when they'll go off. And now you can't actually check your phone. You just traded it with your friend. And I think we have to realize these are not just individual choices. We actually need to, coordinate our choices with each other.
All right, Genevieve, thanks so much for the call. It'll be the last one this hour. Tristan Harris, thanks so much for coming in. And hopefully people picked up some tips for getting control back. And if not, again, that website is timewellspent.io.
TimeWellSpent.io.
.io. All right. Great. Tristan Harris, design thinker, co-founder of Time Well Spent. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thanks to all of you for listening and for all the great calls and comments we got. Sorry we didn't get to all of them. But you can go to our website, go to our Facebook page, and see what other folks are weighing in on about this topic. Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny, who I believe is back tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.